Today is November 17th. We are in our eighth season. This is really the Europe in the 1500s about the Jews. And tonight is the second lecture. We're really starting off with the Renaissance. And last week we were talking about just in general what the Renaissance was. It's just very hard to, I think it's very hard to explain, where just all of a sudden people had a different mindset. As a matter of fact, I was reading a little bit more up on it, and they said that, you know, it's not like one person got up one day and says, "Hey, we're in the Renaissance." You know, actually the name was coined hundreds of years later when they were looking back in history, and they were saying, you know, it was a shift, there was a change that we could notice, a pattern that was changing. And this writer writes that really from after the Black Plague, that was like a big change in Europe, because the Black Plague killed a third of Europe, a third to a half of Europe. So now you had everything in Europe everything is different, because where you used to have a lot of people and serfs were, you know, like nothing, all of a sudden supply and demand, now you needed, there's not enough people to work the land, and, you know, more people were needed, more labor was needed, and therefore that changed the system, the feudal system. So people were able to advance and change, and that made one change. And just basically we were last week, we spoke about that. Right? We'll get back to that again. We were saying is that even during the 13 and 1400s, where in Europe the trade was at a standstill, there was not that much going on. But in Italy, there was still a lot going on. Whereas it may not have been as much maybe as before, but Italy was always like the center of things, whether you were coming from the Muslim lands, whether you're coming from Europe and Spain. So Italy was smack in the middle, and there was always business going on. And if you, Mazel tov to the Meyer house. They weren't here last week because their daughter just got married. So we mentioned last week as well just a few things that caused it. So Italy needed a cosmopolitan type of a new look, because when you want to do business with people from abroad, they come in, they're all different, their cultures are different, and you know you have to give a certain amount of freedom to them. You also need a different type of education. The education that was in Europe at the time was very philosophic. It was very high, you know, in theory. But, you know, in Italy, they needed lemaisa. They needed no business contracts, business laws, lots of things, you know, with all these different types of businesses, commercial, everything that was being struck, and all these deals and everything that needed. You needed a person that would know law, and you needed technology. You needed the latest technologies, whether it's everything that had to do with a boat and or cargo or manufacturing or whatever it was. You needed all these things to happen, and they needed a new type of education. At the same time, there was like an interest in, you know, hey, what happened? Didn't we all come from the Greeks and the Romans? And there was an interest in going back to the sources. The past few hundred years, the church really, people were really learning from the commentaries on the original sources. So I don't know if it was a language thing, or it was the church did not want you to read the original sources because the original sources were not so in line with the church doctrine and thinking. But now there was a movement to learn more about the what happened in Rome and what happened in Greece. Plus the fact two things also helped that is in 1453, Byzantine fell to the Turks. and the Christians that were running from there took with them many books or scrolls or whatever you had, ancient scrolls that weren't available in Western Europe. And all of a sudden, there was a more interest in other ancient scrolls started to become available. And then when you throw in Gutenberg's printing press, and things all of a sudden started being able to become printed, so then it was, I guess this all helped the what we would now call the Renaissance, which in English means rebirth. Did I miss anything that I wanted to say? I think this is just a little bit of a summary of what we've done last week, just to set this up where we are now. So also we just mentioned also something of, along the lines of humanism, is that there was a new idea center that the human, the person, is in the center of the universe, and he could make his own choices, and he can do his own decisions, and he could make the world better, as opposed to before it was more like, that's it, we're only here to get to the next world. That's the way the church wanted you to believe. And that's it, so you live the miserable existence, but it's okay, you'll all get Gan Eden. You'll all get paradise. And now there was a little bit of a difference. You know, maybe we wanted a little bit good here too. We want some Gashmias, we want some nicer buildings, and the arts started to come alive, and started constructions, especially back from the way the Romans and the Greeks had it. And it's again, it all was a new way of thinking. And we also mentioned it wasn't like, you know, everybody in Europe all started thinking this way. This was more a select few, or not just a few, but many, but it did not necessarily affect most of the people in Europe. But quite a bit of intellectuals and businessmen, it did have, it was a definitely a shift. And we just mentioned also it was the first, it was Italy. It was more secular in Italy. And then when the Renaissance went north into Germany, it had took on a little bit of a different shape. It was more within the church. It was more of a religious type of rebirth, a Renaissance. Okay? So we ended last week. We ended last week with talking a little bit about how the Renaissance affected the Jews. So how did it affect the Jews? So we mentioned there were three areas, and one of the areas we mentioned is that the old Jewish doctor. So it seems that the Jews they became physicians. What I guess was more strict with the guilds and you know, keeping Jews out. When the Renaissance came around, it was a little bit more open to having Jews into some of the other trades. Now, it wasn't 100%. It's not like all of a sudden the Jews can get into anywhere and anything. It was still a lot of discrimination. But it was a little easier. It was a little easier at the time. So you mentioned physicians. It also is that you know, everything, the society has an effect on the Jews as well. And on where did I see this? I don't know where Rabbi Irons quotes. I'm not sure what he was quoting, but he was bringing down that for the first time in Jewish history, gambling and card playing became part of the Jewish life. And I guess this was like, again, once the society becomes more open and the Jews are able to be influenced from the people around them. So card playing, there was also more immorality, tznius was not just, was not as where it should be. You know, like when I would say the bad pun, but when in Rome, you know, and they were in Rome, right? So they were just being influenced from the society around them. I guess it was some sort of civil magistracy. I'm not sure if it was a 1 year or a certain period of time, but of 80 cases, and I guess these had to do with Jews, 17 had to do with gambling, 34 moral misdemeanors. That was recorded. I'm not sure if it was 1 year or for many years. There was actually like a place of ill repute in the Jewish quarter, and it was poetry, for the first time it was made poetry, Hebrew poetry, not just secular like I wrote, but even not very tznius. But at the same time, we still have, there were many gedolim at the time, including in the time the Marek. So this was, again, it had a general effect on the Jews. Now, we also mentioned in the second way, we mentioned three different ways where the Jews had either a prominent part, or it was a new opening for the Jews. And the second one was, once they're interested in ancient texts, so now they're interested in Hebrew as well, because all through this time, you know, the Jews always had Hebrew Sfarim, and they're starting, you know, and just like you want to find out what the Latin or the Greek, you know, what it was saying there, so they wanted to find out Hebrew also is also ancient texts, and they wanted to find what was doing there. So many Jews were being hired to translate into the vernacular, whatever that would have been, whether it's German or Italian, the Hebrew text, or even into Latin, and
early universities here in the United States, when they started to be colonized.
Sure, you see Hebrew.
Latin, Hebrew, Greek were required languages.
Okay. As my right, so was it Harvard or Yale?
Yale.
It has like the Luchos with Hebrew letters on it. Aleph, Beis, Gimel. Right, sure. As a matter of fact, over here, the Pilgrims, we mentioned this last time. The Pilgrims took a vote. You know, what's going to be the language of the new country? And the vote was, do we accept Hebrew or I guess English or whatever? But it may, Hebrew, it came to a vote. Now, it could not have come to a vote. They didn't do Chinese, because nobody spoke Chinese, but it must have been, if they had to put it to a vote, it must have been enough of a fluency, of a recognition of Hebrew, to put that to a vote, a possibility. Okay, just a little bit about, I'm really trying to get to a certain, how in general, now I'm talking about in globally, how would the Renaissance affect the Jews as a nation? Not necessarily anybody in particular. One of the earliest humanists or Renaissance people was a person by the name of Pico della Mirandola. I know Pico della Mirandola. And he was one of the earliest. He had some sort of a something called Manifesto of the Renaissance, one of the earliest writings of humanism that there was. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but he was some sort of religion, philosophy, natural philosophy, whatever it was. But it made him famous, and he was a big thinker and an early Renaissance man. What happened with him is he one day was going and he picked up the Kabbalah, the Zohar. He picked up the Zohar. And he was very intrigued about the Zohar. And he started reading it. And then he started becoming more interested in it. Now, to such a point where he said from the Zohar could prove Christianity. So maybe I'll show you, if we can get to it afterwards, I'll show maybe where, how, I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what they're, you know. But maybe I could show a little bit where, you know, you could come to such a thing. But in any case, but that's what he believed. He believed that the Zohar that was becoming very popular. Again, he was in the 1500s, early 1500s, and in Israel at the time, in Eretz Yisrael at the time, you had the Ari, which was coming also up with the Zohar was becoming very, very popular in Israel. And it was making its way all over Klal Yisrael, all over the Jewish people. And again, with the printing press, I think the Zohar was one of the earlier things that were being printed. And he found one, and he started, he was very, very interested in it. So he ended up getting a Yid, a Jew, by the name of Elia del Medigo, who actually sat with him and taught him Hebrew and taught him Aramaic, and in addition, He actually translated many Hebrew manuscripts into Latin for Pico. So he was able to learn a lot of the Jewish learnings.
What is the Jewish Averroes?
I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Maybe a rabbi, some sort of a learning. I don't know what he was, but he was a rav. He had like he was a rav at the time, and he was I think a unique individual. I'm not sure what he didn't fit into the regular what we would have assumed had been a rav at the time. But he was enlightened, and he knew a lot of secular as well as Gemara and learning. Okay, so Pico started picking up Hebrew and he started learning. And then he met up with a person by the name of Ruchlin, Johann Ruchlin, if I'm saying his name correctly. But and this is the person I want to concentrate on because the story with him is tremendously fascinating. And he is going to save the Jewish people from tremendous, tremendous hardships. And so this person, Ruchlin, in 1490, he met up with Pico. And I guess they hit it off. And he was, again, Ruchlin himself was a humanist and also looking, he's interested in this. And he basically showed him the Zohar and Ruchlin became interested in it as well. In 1492, he ends up back in Germany under at Linz, working for the Emperor Frederick. And he meets up with a Jewish physician there, Jacob Ben Yechiel Loans. I think that's how you say the name, Loans. And he met there this Jew, this doctor, who was, I guess, was so learned. And this doctor taught him more about Hebrew. So he learned with his doctor, and he became more familiar with Hebrew and learning. I think he writes about this doctor, that this doctor changed for him the stereotypical Jew. He always thought a Jew was like closed-minded, like nothing, just into their own thing, and whatever the stereotypes of the Jews were in the early 1500s, and it just broke it for him. He met a man who was extremely bright, very worldly, and knowledgeable, and he learned from him. He ends up going back to Italy in 1948, and he meets up with the Sforno, Rav Avadya Sforno, now who ended up becoming the Rav, one of the great leaders of Italian Jewry. We are familiar with the Sforno from the Mikros Gedolos. If you open up any Mikros Gedolos, the one of the Mefarshim is the Sforno. So he met up with the Sforno, and again, the Sforno, he was now teaching him Hebrew even more like diktuk, you know, like very the rudiments of Hebrew and how to read Hebrew and understand it. And Ruchlin himself, he ends up coming to picking up and learning through the Radak. Now, I'm not sure if it is the Radak or David Kimchi that we have in Tanakh. I'm not sure if the Radak is into a diktuk. I'm not sure if he just picked it up from the Radak in Navi, or there was another sefer that the Radak had in diktuk. But to a point where Johann Ruchlin became an expert in Hebrew language with diktuk. He actually came out with his own book in 1506. He wrote a book, The Rudiments Hebraeus, which is a grammar book about Hebrew. All right, again, in order to get it printed, it was costly and it was hard to sell, and especially it was hard to sell because in Germany at the time, the emperor was not allowing Hebrew books to be printed and sold or whatever in Germany. I guess they wanted to try to keep that out as much as possible. But he was able to do it. He was able to get some of his books, his works printed. Okay, so so far this is with Ruchlin. He also was very interested, and he seemed to find in Kabbalah also a hint to Christianity or a support for Christianity in the Zohar. Okay. Comes along, now we switch gears. And we come up with an individual called Pfefferkorn, Johannes Pfefferkorn. Now, Pfefferkorn, we may come back to Pfefferkorn when we speak about Rav Yosselman of Rosheim, who is an unbelievable individual. He ended up was an advocate for the Jewish people. So he had his entire life was helping the Jews of Germany. And he did it for 50 years, and it's a remarkable story. Mr. Shem, we'll talk about him later. But among the people who he had to deal with was this person by the name of Pfefferkorn. Pfefferkorn was a Yid, a Jew, who went over to the dark side. He became a Meshumet, he became a Christian, and then he became very outspoken against the Jews. Again, very often all these Meshumadim, they see the light and they want the Jews to join them. I'm sorry? Okay, so we'll see what happens. I'm switching gears, right? The scene ends. You know, now we go over. Now, you know, we're back at the ranch. You know, now we're in scene two. So, Pfefferkorn, after becoming a Meshubad, meets up with the Dominicans, and they say that, you know what we got to do? We got to get the Jews to convert. And he actually held. That the but he wanted one of the things he wanted to do is he wanted to take all of the books away from the Jews, because he really felt three things were keeping the Jews and not Christians. I mean, many other things, but one is that usury, they were used to make loans. You know, he used it in a negative way, but Jews in Europe were the money lenders, and you know, if there's no cash available, you can't make businesses, you can't, you know, so it does play a part. And because the Christians didn't allow Christians to do, you know, to ribbis with charge interest, you know, so they had the Jews do it. Look, they're going to get ahead of them anyway, so why can't they, you know, just let them get the interest. And he felt that because of this job is the interest is being able to do that. That was keeping them as Jews. Secondly, he held that the reason why they're Jews and not Christians is because they don't hear enough shmuzim. You know, they don't hear enough sermons. You know, if they hear another, you know, so that's the second thing. And thirdly, is because they honor their books, their Talmud. And to the third end, he wanted to confiscate the Talmud, and that's it. So. To that point, is he made a claim that the Talmud is anti-Christian. And, you know, it has been done before, this claim, and to varying degrees of success. And we spoke a lot about the book burning in 1242 in France. And he made such a claim again. And of course, he had the church behind him, and they were all into this too. And now it has to make its way to the emperor. So the emperor now has to make a decision: does he confiscate the books and burn them or not? So to that point, at first Pfefferkorn didn't know where Ruchlin stood, so he sent to Ruchlin to be a jurist, you know, be the one to make one of those to make the decision if the Jews in fact were. If their books were anti-Christian or not. And Ruchlin didn't want to have any part of this. He tried, you know, I guess he must have had an affinity to Jews and their learning, because he met some very, very special people, you know, and he didn't want to get involved with this, and he kept pushing it off. And he was only able to push it off until Maximilian, I guess the emperor at the time, told him, I need your decision. What are you writing? What do you have to say? So this is now we're the year is 1510, and he tells him, you have to come down and we want you to make the psak. So this was his answer. His answer was definitely not just the opposite of what the church and Pfefferkorn hoped for. But basically something like he divided all of Jewish books into six parts. Now he says, first of all, we're not talking about the Bible in Hebrew, because that's not up for, you know, debate. And there's a certain amount of books that the that the Jews, actually, there are a few books that, that are against Christianity, but the Jews don't care about those books. That's not, you want to confiscate the Talmud and everything else. But there are very few of those books, and they're not the Ikkar, they're not what's really important to the Jews. Then there was a second group of books, which were licensed by the Pope. The Pope knows about these books. The Zohar, I believe, is included. And the Pope allows these books to be used and not to be confiscated. And third, he says, there's another group of books, I think here he meant the Zohar and maybe the Talmud, that has so much knowledge in there, the fact that it's not Christian, okay, so big deal, but to confiscate them, you're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You're going to just destroy, so much. And then he said, he went the other way. He says, not only that, but I think every college should have two Jews on their board that would help with Jewish books, either translate them and help you with and that really didn't go over well. So that caused a big, that caused everybody to go against Ruchlin. So the one thing is that the Ruchlin, everybody disagreed, and they told Maximilian, no, just take him away anyway. But I guess Ruchlin held sway, that he was a very prominent person, and it was enough his opinion held, and the books were not taken away. So it just saved the Jews a tremendous, tremendous amount of tsaris, of issues. Pfefferkorn said that Ruchlin had been bribed, of course, and then Ruchlin defended himself with something called, I don't even know how to say this, Ugenspiegel, and to protect himself, to defend himself. This is why I said it, and it's not true. But then all the churches confiscated that, and they didn't want that to be, they didn't want the defense of Ruchlin to get out there, because they were all on the side of Pfefferkorn. So Ruchlin ended up having a lot of tsaras. They were hounding him. Eventually it did cause another wide rift in the church. The church did not need this, again, they had all their other issues that were happening. And then finally he was back in Italy, they had a certain trial, and by 1516, but by that time, this whole thing washed over. It wasn't like headline news anymore. Like all these issues, that happen in the news today, 3 weeks, 4 weeks down the line, when you find out the real story, they just print it in the back page, So same thing is pretty much here. Ruchlin, he had all these tsaras. But what also happened is, the reason why Ruchlin lost center stage, they sort of forgot about Ruchlin, is because it was around this time that Martin Luther started making his. It's around this time that Martin Luther put up the 22 questions or theses or whatever, 92, I forgot the number, but he put up, and that made it, now they had somebody else to go after, and they had bigger problems, more than just one guy, Ruchlin. Now, he was a priest, and everybody was, and it caused a big storm. And then we're going to talk about the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, also on a different time. But this deserves its entirety as well. And he actually said, "Thank God that they have somebody who else they could deal with. They don't have to leave. They could leave me alone." Greitz and Yeats, they actually held that the this thing of Ruchlin was actually one of the sparks that helped make the Protestant Reformation. So the Protestant Reformation, where the church is actual split, and even today you got your Protestants and your Christians, all this. So I guess the time was ripe for Luther to come along and for that split to happen. It was, the atmosphere was built on from Ruchlin. And all this Ruchlin, where did he get his things from? He got it from, so the Jews. So it's like, I guess, You see how Hashem runs the world. You know, you have this one person who is influenced by a few Jews who ends up saving, you know, the Jews in Germany from losing all of their Sfarim. Okay, where could you get it from? The Zohar? Well, there's in Parshas Hazinu, in Daf Reish Pei Ches, you can come up. This is a part of a Zohar. This is one of the things where you may want to take it from here. This could mean anything, but there's a Chachma Ilah. There's a very high Chachma that's the Ihi Reisha that's in the head. Bei Sasim, it's hidden. The Ikri Mucha Elah, and it's called the higher brain. Okay, so there's Ikri, there's a higher brain and a hidden brain and a Mucha de Shachich v'shaket. And I don't know what Shachich is, but a silent brain. There's three parts of the brain. V'les diyadale bar ihu, and nobody knows where it is or what it is. Talas Reishin is Palgin, and these three heads, Da Lagoy Minda. One is higher than the other, Vidali Ela Minda. One is inside the other, one is above the other. And it just goes on. Reisha Chada Chachmasa Satima. I'm not exactly sure, but you know, the important word here is three. Three. That's it. Once you get to three, there's three. So you could, you know. If it's so, when you have things like this, that who knows what it means? I mean, who knows what it means? If you know the Zohar and you know you have a Rebbe and you can and you understand what these concepts and ideas are, then you know what it really means. But if you're just reading this and you're just trying to, you could stick anything you want into here. So this may be one instance, one area where in fact they may have gotten their ideas from the Zohar, and they may have had many other things like this. You know, I guess you look for certain things. You see that? Now we have it. Okay, any questions on this or anything? Because I just want to go back to the printing press. Because the printing press, just maybe a little bit more into what the Jews had. You know, so you know, the printing, we just spoke about the printing press in general. Maybe we'll just go back to that. Again, the printing press in the old days, you wanted to make one copy. It required about 170 calves and of a, what is this? If you wanted a book, you need 170 calves, 300 sheepskins to produce an average manuscript of the entire Christian Bible. That's one. In an efficient factory, like, it would take you only 45 scribes, 22 months, to complete 200 books. So I guess, you know, each one was writing the same section. This is the book. You could imagine the expense of what a book was, and it's not a wonder why, you know, all of Europe was illiterate. Like, you know, you had to get, how do you do this? How do you get the books to read? Even then, okay, so paper. Then paper came a little later. So good. So you didn't have the 170 calves and sheepskins. It became a little cheaper. But after all said and done, it was still very, very expensive. I mean, the time, the writing, everything had to be written over. By the way, this is we did this too. We did this for Gemara, for the Talmud. You know, after it was written out. So for the next, the Rabban and Savroy, one of their jobs were to make so many copies, and these copies made it all over the world. I think a bigger nace, which I don't know how this was possible, was Rashi. When Rashi made a commentary on the Gemara, right? So the Rabban and Savroy, when the Gemara was completed in the year 500, so this was in Bavel, and there was an academy, there was a yeshiva, this was the yeshiva of the world. So the Gemara that was written by Rav Ashi, so yes, it was constantly being edited for the next, I don't know, 50 years or so, and, you know, perfected. But yet at the same time, you had an entire yeshiva, everybody being able to copy it over. So you had like a whole yeshiva doing this. When Rashi wrote his commentary on Gemara and on Chumash, he had, what did he have, five daughters? Like, you know, four daughters? What did he have? He had like, what did he do? How was it possible that Rashi's commentary, and this is again, Rashi was in Rashi died in the year 1096. No, Rashi he was born in 1096 and he died in the
1142.
No, he died 1142, right? But he was around for the first crusade, which was in 1092. But I'm sorry. He died 1104. That's much better, because towards the end of his life, he was 1092 was the first crusade, and even though it wasn't true, but you know the Bouillon, right? The French Duke Knight. And he said he had a conversation with him, and then he said, "You're gonna come back with only 3 horses," and he came back with 2 horses, and he came back with 3 horses, and on the way in, the gate fell and killed 1 horse. But it's not true, because the one who they said about him died in Jerusalem, never made his way back. All right, but in any case, but the miracle of Rashi is somehow the whole world got Rashi's commentary on the Gemara and on Chumash. Amazing. So now you're introducing the printing press. So comes along the printing press, and Gutenberg, he was an inventor. He came up with like 4 different, he needed 4 different technologies that he put them all together. One of them was a jeweler by trade. He was he worked with gold and metals. So he was able to make the metal, what is it called, the metal, the mattress, the matrices, the little metal pieces that would have letters on them. That was one of the things that he did, something along the lines like this. You see this was something that he created himself. I mean, there was such a thing before, but he was the one. In China, they had a similar type of a thing, and also bookbinders would have some things where they would like stamp on the front cover, you know, put like a symbol or 2 or 3 letters. So he just took that and just made it so you could have all these words. This is pretty much a reconstruction of what it was. Here you'd have the paper. Down here was where you'd put the ink. Here was the press part, and it was just it was all put together. When it finally came about, so within 50 years, like 200 cities had one. By 1500, which is about almost 50 years, a little more than 50 years, about 50 years later, there were 20 million volumes of books, you know, in 50 years. 16th century, in the next 100 years, you had like 200 million copies of books. So you're right. It was like probably the greatest invention, I wouldn't say since the wheel, but one of the greatest inventions that came about that changed the world was this printing press. Again, this is the picture. He's inking it. This is where the pictures are. You folded it over. Then you put it under the press. The press would evenly go down and everything would be inked. So you had paper, which was necessary. You also the ink. Now on metal, the ink that they were using, water-based, didn't stick to metal. So he had to create an oil-based ink. Just another. All these different things were he used. Then the screw press, which was around, used for like grapes. He used that to evenly be able to push down so the ink would evenly go on all the paper, and that's it. There's an example of a screw press and the matrix. So he put that in. It would go under the paper, and each piece of paper was put down. It was inked. It was the press put it down evenly. It came up, and that's it. You had a full page. You were able to move with the letters, as many letters as you want. So you built yourself, you wrote your words in your page, and then you put it underneath the paper on top. You inked it with an oil-based ink that would stick to the metal, and then you pressed it down, and that's it. You had a page, and then you did a few of those, and then eventually you ended up with a book. the codex also, I think, is the format. They, instead of a scroll, they did like a book. So therefore, you could write on both. You could on both sides of a page. It was a lot cheaper, and it was more efficient, easier to read. Paper also. It was paper was also something which was relatively new. Originally, it was also created in China, and somehow that technology ended up making it way to Europe. Yes.
When did tweed come into play? I thought they originated from Ethiopia.
I think it was originally made from what's hemp?
Hmm?
What is hemp? Is that from trees, or is that some sort of like a plant?
Hemp is a plant.
It's a plant. So originally the paper was made from hemp. This is going back then, I think, in the first, I don't know which century, but this was originally in China. A guy he figured out how to make paper. And then constantly just kept getting better at it. So now today we probably use tree pulp as opposed to hemp or whatever it is. And then that's how paper, I'm not exactly sure exactly how all the paper came about, but that's how it came about, the technology of paper.
They keep talking about chopping down trees and as part of an environmental effort. Well, if we do less paper, put more things on computer, do less paper, we'll save more trees.
Okay. As much as this, so here they are, they're trying to save all the trees to such a point where they don't even allow you to burn the dead trees. And now take a look at California. I mean, this is, but all right, I'm sure there has to be some sort of a balance, you know. But you're right. I don't know the world, but Baruch Hashem, it seems that we have trees and we have paper and we have what we need. So do we have to be careful of our resources? Yeah, absolutely. All right, but that was another, paper was something else, oil-based ink, that was another chiddush, so he had to put this together. It took him years to put all this together. It wasn't like one day he figured out this and one day, so he was an inventor, and after a few years, after what ended up with Gutenberg is he ended up printing, but he owed so much money that his creditor ended up taking over his press and made all the money. So he developed it, and he ended up in the courts, he lost it to his creditor, or his partner, I think, who he owed the money to. Just like in contrast, by 1500, 6 million books about, and it took 15 days to disseminate Luther's pamphlets. Again, Luther, without a printing press, it just would have probably been a local problem, and it never would have made its way, it would never would have had its wide listening, dissemination on everybody hearing it, because once they heard his, we'll talk about Luther, what his issues were with the church. But originally he just wanted to be a reformer. He just wanted to save the church. You know, they were doing things which are not right, and he was right on many issues. And when they started hearing Luther's, his tainas on the church, they said, he's making a lot of sense. You know, and eventually, instead of, just listening to it and changing, they decided to fight and squash. And then that, I guess like they say, the rest is history. So where do the Jews come in? So the Jews, it first took about, it is about 25 years later. What was the first dated Hebrew book? Or some say it was Rashi's commentary of the Torah, 1475. Some say there's other books that you can get down to 1469. But the question is what took so long? I mean, this was already in the 1450s, so not till 25 years later. What took 25 years? So, could be a few things. First of all, Jews are always like wary of change. That could be. Secondly, is that it could be that, copyists was a big, must have been a big profession back then. You were a professional copyist. In other words, if you wanted a, let's say you wanted a shas for your, for a chassan. So maybe just like you go to a sofer to write a sefer Torah, you probably maybe have gone to a copyist to copy over and make you a shas. You know, so it must have been a big business, writing over. And they probably were you know, the printing press put those people out of business, so they weren't able to work anymore. But eventually, it did come about, and once it came about, it was like you see over here. By 1500, 200 Hebrew titles came out. I mean, you could imagine. The Hebrew press, it began in many places. Now, of course, again, like everything else, they wouldn't allow necessarily Jews to run them. So you had to get like a non-Jewish partner or owner, and then the Jews would help. Now, the most famous one that we know of is Sansino. The Sansino today, or there used to be a Sansino English Gemara, nothing to do with the old Sansinos. They just picked up the name. So in the 15th century, there were two main places where, again, the 1400s, two main places. One was in Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, and in Italy. That's where you had most of the printing press, printing for Jewish Sfarim. Now, of course, in Spain, that ended in 1492. That's it, and there was no more printing there. And in 1496, when they forcibly converted all the Jews, they also had a book burning of all Sfarim in Portugal, which we may yet get to. But the Sephardim that left, when they relocated in the Ottoman Empire. In the 16th century, besides Italy, you also had in Prague, you had in Krakow, Sassino. They were pioneers. Sassino made actually the Gemara and the Mishneh Torah. Those were two major projects that they did. Today, our Gemaras are fashioned after the way Sassino fashioned it. Let's just say, yeah, this was like a, I think this is actually a copy of a Sansino. The Gemara was in the middle, and Rashi and Tosfos. And that's, you know, we now have a lot of things on the outside, and, you know, sometimes we'll have like Rabbeinu Gershom, other Rishonim, and the Ein Yaakov, which tells where you could find it in other books. And these were all added as subsequent printings came. Another very early book, just simple Rashi, Gemara. Sometimes the Gemara didn't have even the same daf. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even say the daf number here, right? It doesn't even say the daf number, but okay. So it was just the daf numbers came at a later one. This is the Mishneh Torah that Sassino came out with. Now he writes over here in his preface to the Michlal of Radak. He writes. When he was looking for Tosfos, you know, the Tosfos were all manuscripts. They're all written. He actually traveled to France to get the manuscripts. He was a Talmud Chacham. He knew how to read. I'm sure he had other Rabbanim on the staff, like art school does today. They have big Talmud Chachamim in terms of translating and making sure everything is right. And he traveled to France to find the manuscripts of Rabbeinu Yitzchak and Rabbeinu Tam. So which Tosfos made it in and didn't make it in, a lot had to do with Sassino and the other early printers. Now, he ended up, he only made 23 of the tractates. What he did is he called up the yeshivas and he found out, what are you learning next month? And they said, okay, we're learning Baba Kama. So we did Baba Kama. You're learning Baba Metzia. So he only ended up only doing 23. The first full set of shas is going to be by a Bromberg, a different printer, a non-Jewish printer. He actually writes over here, he's writing in his prefix, he says the publishers of Venice, which is Bamberg and Edelkind, copied from my press. In other words, they stole his design. He, you know, the whole thing with the four lines of Rashi and four lines of Tosfos, the way the Gemara has, we have it now, is pretty much from Sansino. They took that design and they printed his same volumes using his style, plus they did other volumes. So besides the 23, there was another, the addition, all the rest of them were done by Bonberg, and he was, I think, the first one to come out with a full shas. So he writes Hebrew books written by Christians. Okay, and at some point the Hebrew market was almost as like the non-Hebrew market. This was a Bonberg's Talmud. This is how it looks. This was a this is the first complete Talmud was Daniel Bamberg. Again, he was a non-Jewish printer with Jews working for him. I guess maybe this is, again, Sassino says, he actually relocated from Italy. He relocated to Salonika under the Turks. They continued into Egypt. The family Sansino for like 100 years. They were printers. He writes how he supported the converts, the conversos that were escaping from Portugal. And he writes in 1526 in the prefix to the Yalkut Shimoni. He's Yalkut Shimoni here in the city of Salonika. That he was already in Salonika. And now I guess maybe we'll stop here because I want to just next time we'll go into some of the book burnings that were done. This is one of the early ones, but there was a book because of some non-Jewish printers. It made its way to the Pope, and they ended up burning a lot of books in Italy. So, all right, any questions or any? Okay, so maybe we'll end it here.